You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, friends.
Kara is once again busy working because she has a new project that she's working on. So, guys, you all heard about Lorraine Warren, right?
Yes.
Yep. Yes. Shed her earthly yes. coil.
Yeah, so Lorraine Warren, part of the Warrens duo, Ed and Lorraine Warren, she died on Friday at the age of 92.
Good run.
Her husband, Ed, died in 2006 at the age of 79. So she outlived him by 13 years, not uncommon for women to outlive their husbands. So yeah, so we had a little bit of a to-do with the Warrens when we were first getting started with the Connecticut, at that time, Connecticut Skeptical Society, then the New England Skeptical Society, because Ed and Lorraine Warren are probably the most famous ghost hunters, you know, gullible ghost hunters, probably in the world, right? I don't know of anyone who got to their level.
Well, they were behind Amityville Horror, which was huge.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, their career led to, inspired not only the Amityville Horror, but Annabelle and The Conjuring.
Yeah, The Conjuring series. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Several horror movie franchises.
And there were made-for-TV movies about them before. Yeah. Prior to that, obviously, they sold a lot of books. So they were a bit of a media power unto themselves in their own right.
Right. And all based on nothing.
Zero.
You know, really, just on just the self-created fiction.
You call yourself a demonologist, and there you go.
You make shit up.
And she exactly. called, I believe she called herself, oh, she had the ability, a clairaudient, I think yes. is how she referred to herself.
Yeah. Yes.
The ability to just hear things, hear sounds from...
Drums from the deep.
So my
from the paranormal realm.
The depths of Moria. Remember the story Randy told us during the Amityville Horror investigation?
Yeah, yes.
And they were driving
awesome.
Over there. They get out of the cab and she like falls to the ground, sensing the psychic power. It's so strong. The presence here is unbelievable. And they said, the house is down the road.
Yeah, two houses down.
Yeah, she fell to her knees, right? And was like, you could feel it. It's like, yeah.
Oh, never mind.
You missed your cue, Lorraine. Jumped the gun.
Wow. You know, they were just this old, clueless couple. But they, you know, the media impression of them, there was such a disconnect between sort of the Hollywood mythology and the reality. It was really palpable.
I'll never forget that afternoon. We spent an afternoon with them, right? I mean, we talked with them. We kind of interviewed them. They showed us their incredibly the most haunted basement in the world.
We saw Annabelle.
And yeah. And I
is
remember,
that the doll that? You touched, Bob? Did you touch the Annabelle?
Yes. I think.
Did you touch the case that held the doll?
Yes, Annabelle.
Oh,
I touched a lot of stuff down there. I'm still waiting to die. It's been I think I passed the statute of limitations. But what was that famous quote she said to us, guys?
You know,
she
was like, "Science that did it to you."
Yeah, well, yeah. What
happened to you boys? Was it the science?
Was it the science?
As if it's an affliction.
I think that they really enjoyed the fame, and you know, they enjoyed all of the mystique that came with it, and they believed. You know, and it's
but there was a lot of pious fraud going on too, though.
Yeah,
we also heard from dozens of people who used to work with the Warrens.
Oh yeah,
who then eventually, after a while, went their own way because they realized that they were frauds, basically. Like they would get true believers into their classes and to work with them, and then the true believers realized that this couple was just scamming them. You know.
Yeah, in unsophisticated ways too.
So then, so then they would go off and do real ghost hunting, you know,
real ish.
Yeah,
yeah. They burned a lot of bridges. It seems a lot of people burned bridges with the Warrens. It's been their history, and I also always had the sense that Lorraine was quite devout and hinged, I think, everything she experienced and felt on that devotion, whereas Ed, you know, had a certain level of devotion to him, but I think he also might have been kind of the brains behind the enterprise of it all and saw that they were able to turn this thing into some real money for them and, you know, had almost that Carnival P.T. Barnum kind of sense yeah. about him. You know, he was selling a show.
Exactly.
Didn't really care too much. I mean, was he all, you know, he didn't seem all that. He didn't try to sell us too hard on their ideas, I felt. You know, he says, here's what we got, and believe it or not, this is what it is. And
no, I thought it was pretty clear, though, that he wanted our approval, you know.
He would have loved our approval.
Yeah, and he was very disappointed when we wrote a negative, you know, review of his evidence, such as it was.
Which appeared in the Connecticut Post, I believe. They picked up our story, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it was
not I don't care what those guys say. That kid disappeared.
Yeah.
Damn the science.
Got to talk to them like they're on a third grade level. Thanks, Ed.
He was really cynical. No, he was totally cynical about his audience. He knew that they were gullible.
Yeah.
You know,
See, that's why it was like this more of salesman than anything else.
No, he was a carnival barker. You're absolutely right. That's what he was. And this was his shtick. And, you know, and we saw stuff that he was putting forward as evidence that we knew was faked.
Were they faking it because they wanted people to come in so they can make money? Or was it more they were faking it to get people because they believed, but just wanted evidence, quote unquote evidence?
I think it's a false dichotomy. I think that they believe their own BS at some level, but.
Yeah. Especially in the beginning.
Yeah. It's like the pious fraud thing where it's like you believe, but it's okay to cut corners and cheat a little bit because it's all. Towards proving what you know to be true anyway. Yeah. But they certainly enjoyed, this was their living. They made a living off of convincing people that, you know, they were seeing ghosts.
Yep.
And they made this circuit of all the colleges in the Connecticut area talking to college students about, you know, giving their crappy lectures.
Oh, every October it was, you know, October 1st. Okay, where are the Warrens going to be this month? You got the whole list of their appearances every October.
No, they spawned a little cottage industry of ghost hunting.
Yeah, and certainly had an influence on people in the ghost hunting industry to follow. You know, they blaze certain trails in that regard, and, you know, we're here to clean up the mess. I don't know how else do you put it?
Yeah.
How else can you say it?
Oh, well, the end of an era. Now Ed and now Lorraine gone as well.
Yep, but their estate lives on, which owns all the rights to a lot of these things that are making lots of money. So,
well, they formed the New England Society for Psychic Research, you know, which never does any actual research, which is still operating, apparently. I don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, right.
They were the ones who had the website. So they had a website telling you how to take ghost photography. And one of their instructions was to use a flash, the brighter the better.
Of course.
Right. So we pointed out that, yeah, that's because you get flashback. And we showed examples of flashback and how it makes ghost globules and, you know, misty images and whatnot. And then that mysteriously disappeared from their website.
that information disappeared. Oh, gosh.
No insight whatsoever. Okay. Let's do some news items.
Yeah.
Jay, this is kind of a quirky little technical thing, but, you know, they're claiming that they could cool things without using energy in apparent defiance of the laws of thermodynamics. Now, no one goes screwing around with thermodynamics on this show.
Yeah, right?
Please. Not on your watch.
Nope. Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know what to make of this. Let's just go through it, and then hopefully as more information comes out, we'll find out if it's legit. I really don't see any reason to heavily suspect that it isn't, but let's take a look. So physicists at the University of Zurich, they developed a simple device that allows heat to flow temporarily from a cold to a warm object without an external power supply. And you're like, well, so what? Well, let's get into the details here. So the kicker with this is that the process they developed initially appears to contradict the fundamental laws of physics. But wait a minute. No, it doesn't. And that's what they say. So this is bad news reporting. It seems counterintuitive, but then upon further investigation, I guess they're claiming that it does not break the laws. So here's the details. So to paint the picture, let's say you just poured yourself a cup of hot coffee. So on a side note, the best temperature to brew coffee at is 205 degrees Fahrenheit, 96.1 degrees Celsius. But Bob, don't let me get sidetracked about talking about coffee right now.
Too late.
So you got this hot cup of coffee and you put it on your kitchen table. Now, what do you expect to happen to the cup of coffee?
It'll cool down.
Yeah.
And how much will it cool down, Evan?
It will cool down eventually to room temperature.
Right.
Well, room temperature plus a tiny fraction.
Whatever. Don't worry about that.
Approaching room temperature.
What we expect unanimously is that it will get to become the exact temperature of the things that surround it. So, and it'll stay at room temperature, right? Now, this is a perfect example of the second law of thermodynamics. To explain this law, heat can flow by itself only from a warmer to a colder object and not the other way around. This is why things cool off to match their surroundings.
I could see that happening, yeah.
Now, Steve, is it wrong for me to also say that things will heat up to match their surroundings?
Sure. You put something in the oven. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, but if you take something out of the refrigerator and put it on the kitchen table, yeah, it'll warm up to match your surroundings.
Yeah.
So neither of these two things is breaking the second law of thermodynamics.
Now, as long as the energy is flowing from the relatively hotter to the relatively cooler thing.
Right. That's right. So even in the cold thing warming up, the warm air is flowing into the cold object.
Mm-hmm.
Or the heat energy is, actually. So the research group led by Andreas Schilling in the Department of Physics at the University of Zurich seem to have developed a process that challenges the second law in some way, or just puts a little, like, you know, asterisk at the end of it. And here's what they did. They cooled a 9-gram piece of copper that was over 100 degrees Celsius to way below room temperature without any external power supply.
That's right, copper.
That's right, Gabbert. So Schilling said, theoretically, this experimental device could turn boiling water to ice without using any energy. Again, you would think the boiling water would eventually give off enough heat that it would match the temperature of its surroundings. So how did they do it? So they used something called a Peltier element. This device has two sides, and when a DC electric current flows through the device, it brings heat from one side to the other, so that one side gets cooler while the other side gets hotter. The hot side is attached to a heatsink so that it remains at an ambient temperature, while the cool side goes below room temperature. In some applications, multiple coolers can be used to cascade together to lower the temperature. Okay, so this Peltier element can transform electric current into temperature differences. That's essentially what it does. The cool thing here is that the researchers use the device without any energy source. Check this out. Thermal oscillation still happened, and the process does not break any laws of physics. To be clear, they observed heat moving from the colder copper to the warmer heat bath with no need to be transformed into another form of energy. So, of course, real-world applications are still far off because, you know, there's limitations of today's non-efficient Peltier elements, so meaning that, you know, that you'll find them in, like, the small refrigerator that you'll see in a hotel room. They usually call that, like, a wet bar type of deal in a hotel. They'll use a Peltier device in there, because it's not really cooling that much, and they're super low maintenance, no moving parts. Like, these things will last for a very long time. So, but the scientists are saying that they need a much more efficient Peltier element to be created, so the thermal circuits could be used nonstop without the need of any power, and that they think that if they got something that was at, you know, at the efficiency that they were saying, that we could see some pretty amazing things happen. Now, they didn't explain, as far as I could find anywhere, exactly what was happening in the world of physics, like what was actually taking place. But they did say that the team believes that the research that they did isn't just a simple proof of principle study, that it's beyond that, that it's working, and that they saw a measurable difference. You know, they saw the heat transfer happening. It was measurable, and that it was happening consistently, that those types of things are, you know, if they're true, are very important. Steve, what do you think, man? I'm a little confused about this.
So I think the bottom line here is that what they were able to show is that, obviously, even though, you know, heat flowing from a cooler to a warmer object appears to violate the second law of thermodynamics, that with their setup, the entropy of the overall system is in fact increasing.
Right.
So that doesn't violate the second law. But, you know, when going to the original study, it says the reason for this is, and then it's like math that you don't understand. Yeah. You have to.
It's math.
Yeah. Which you need more advanced math than I have to understand. So obviously it gets pretty wonky at that point. But, and it all has to do something with this Peltier LCR circuit is the key, apparently. So, I mean, you know, it's interesting, but you always want to know, like, all right, can I have a refrigerator that doesn't use electricity, right? That's what we want to know. Yeah. And that seems unlikely, doesn't it? I don't think that we're.
I don't see how we're getting to that.
They say this like where this is not anywhere close to any large scale applications, but it's hard to know if it would even be theoretically possible, that kind of a thing, or is it just one of these? It's got to be only in certain specialized circumstances that would never be actually useful for anything.
Right. I mean, it seems like destined to be a lab curiosity forever.
Yeah.
The fact that it happens though can lead to who knows what that could lead to. Even if we can't get a free refrigerator.
The headlines are ridiculous. And the image that went with the article that I read, like it shows like a pot of boiling water. And then it shows like an interstitial like temperature. And then it shows that water as a block of ice. Like, please.
Yeah.
From my research, this is a legitimate research group. Like there's something legit going on. I just don't feel like they really explained it in a way that the average person can understand.
No, they didn't.
I'm always skeptical whenever I see the two words energy and free together in the same sentence. You know, I mean, I just do.
But this is a good example, though, Jay. I think the thing that's interesting here is this is a very math-heavy, wonky topic. And did they talk to anybody who could explain it in a way that a knowledgeable layperson could understand? Can you explain the concept so that I can understand it without having to actually know the math? And I think they failed to do that.
Yeah.
Is the bottom line, like how this actually works, which I don't know. Does that mean that they don't really understand how it works? Or, you know what I mean? Conceptually, on a deep conceptual level, so they can translate it. That's often where like the real genius of good science communication is, when you have that, you know, when you have to explain a topic that really only makes sense at a highly technical level, and then explain it so that it's understandable, at least at a reasonable level, to somebody who doesn't have the specific technical information. But we'll see. Probably people will email us who can't explain this a little bit better, or we'll see. Maybe it doesn't make sense ultimately. But I agree. I think the bottom line is, okay, maybe technically they're doing this without breaking the second law of thermodynamics, but I still don't think we're going to get our free refrigerators that don't need to use electricity. All right, Bob. Now, this article isn't hyped at all. Apparently, physicists have found the very first molecule ever to exist in the universe.
Yeah.
Sure you did.
Yeah. They looked there and said, oh, there it is.
And that has come from SOFIA, the NASA's Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, which has observed the first molecule ever to form in the universe, helium hydride, or perhaps I should say the first type of molecule ever to form in the universe, helium hydride. The story of what that is, what this means, and what lots of news outlets are getting wrong is what I will be regaling you with for the next 10 minutes or so. So helium hydride, to better understand what that is, why this molecule is important in this context, we need to look back very briefly at the very, very early universe when the Big Bang nucleosynthesis left us with a universe of just hydrogen and helium and tiny bits of deuterium and lithium. For you pedants out there, we love you dearly, but it's mainly hydrogen and helium. Now, everything was ionized. Things were just way too hot and active for atoms as we know them to form, and for electrons to enter stable orbits around the nucleus. So it took actually 132,000 years for two electrons to stay in their funky little orbits around a helium nuclei, right? Two protons, two neutrons, and two electrons. So the nuclei were hanging out, but it took a while, 132,000 years, for two electrons to stably orbit around that nucleus. And this, when that happened, it was the first stable neutral atom ever, helium. Hydrogen wasn't so lucky. It took 380,000 years approximately for a single proton, which is a hydrogen nucleus, right, to pair up with an electron to make a stable neutral hydrogen that we know and love today. That relatively brief period of time, though, between those two events, between when helium had its shit together, but hydrogen was still just bare protons flitting around, was when the first true molecules formed. Now, that happened when helium atoms and ionized hydrogen, right? That's what we're talking about here. Helium atoms and ionized hydrogen collide, forming a molecular bond and releasing a very distinctive photon. a photon that's directly, the energy of that photon is directly related to the strength of that bond. That forms the molecule helium hydride, and theory says it would had to have been the very first molecule ever. This is a major milestone, obviously, in the history of the universe. It's essentially the dawn of chemistry itself, all those many billions of years ago. This is not this crazy special molecule that can only be found in space. We've been making it since 1925, but actually having observational evidence of it in space, naturally occurring, has been extremely, extremely hard. The photons that are released in this creation is far infrared. So that means that our atmosphere would absorb the hell out of it, which means, of course, that we can't detect it from the ground. So you got to use some sort of imaging satellite. You got to get above the atmosphere. And imaging satellites could potentially detect them, but it just seemed like there was never quite the right type of instrumentality on any of those satellites to detect it. The SOFIA Observatory is a wonderful example of a hybrid telescope of sorts. This is really fascinating. It has the benefits of both ground and space observatories, but fewer their disadvantages. So observing from space is fantastic, right? Because you're above the atmosphere, which it can obscure, it can distort, or it could outright hide what you're looking for. Ground observatories, though, have the advantage that you can upgrade them often, you know, and much, much more cheaply than upgrading anything in space. They don't require insane space launch costs, and the size of the ground-based observatories aren't constrained by the size of your rocket, right? Yeah. So SOFIA flies on a really specially modified, beautiful Boeing 747 that flies at 45,000 feet. And when it was recently upgraded with the latest terahertz technology, they finally spotted the telltale signals of this helium hydride.
Were they looking for it, Bob?
Oh, absolutely. Dude, they've been looking for this for decades, and they could never quite see it or detect it. And this was the perfect scenario where you can get above the atmosphere and you could tweak the instruments to get it just right to detect what you wanted to detect. So now this is what many news outlets miss, though. You kind of alluded to that in the beginning. This isn't the actual first molecules that they spotted. Those molecules died long ago, many billions of years ago, when neutral hydrogen was able to form and kick the helium hydride to the curb. Done. Probably fairly quickly, there was none left. So what was spotted was newly forming helium hydride, and it was just where we thought it would be. They actually thought that this is where we're going to find helium hydride, by this planetary nebula. For example, I think they found it at NGC 7027. This is a planetary nebula, a dying sun-like star, which would have an abundance of the two things that you want, right? Ionized hydrogen and neutral helium. Bam, that's it. They knew it was going to be there, and it was, once they had the proper instrument to detect it. Now, this confirms theories of the early universe and the more modern universe, right, around us, which, of course, is always nice. You know, who wasn't happy when that's done? But finally seeing these natural examples of in space of the first molecular bonds and molecules is extra special. This simple helium hydride molecular bond was the first domino. Think about it. It was the first domino of chemistry that led to everything that you see around you. And if you dive into that a little deeper, that very first domino, this was critically important, more so than I had thought. Think about it. You've got stars forming, but stars don't form from atomic hydrogen, just regular hydrogen with a proton and an electron. So, you know, imagine the universe is cooling and like, okay, the universe is cool enough. Now we're going to take atomic hydrogen and have it collapse into a star. And that's not going to happen. Atomic hydrogen is far too reactive for that to happen. You need to get two hydrogen atoms paired together, and together they make a very stable molecular hydrogen, and that's what stars are mostly from. All those clouds in space of collapsing hydrogen, that's molecular hydrogen that are collapsing, creating stars. And the theory says that the atomic hydrogen needs to have a chemical reaction with helium hydride to make molecular hydrogen. So I'm going to say that again. Hydrogen needs to react with helium hydride in order to make molecular hydrogen. Without it, this universe would be incredibly different and probably much more boring. Of course, that simple first chemical reaction led ineluctably not only to stars, but also to planets, to biology, to people, and of course, peanut butter. Thank you, helium hydride.
So, Bob, when you say molecular hydrogen, Why is it? What do you mean molecular hydrogen?
It's two hydrogen atoms that have bonded together. So you've
to do
got
what?
To hang out, you know, to hang out.
So it's a molecule of hydrogen.
Right. Well, so you've got two protons, two electrons, and that makes it incredibly stable, and it's not going to go off and react with all these other elements like regular atomic hydrogen would with one proton and one electron. So because it's so stable, it could last for a really long time. It could gather together into the huge clouds and then collapse under its own weight to create stars. If you look through space for atomic hydrogen, you're not going to find a lot of it. There's very, very little of it out there because it's all been converted. It's all been converted to this this stable molecular hydrogen. So pretty important. Pretty important. It's just fascinating to think that without helium hydride, none of that molecular hydrogen would have been created, or not nearly what we see. And who knows? I mean, there may be no stars. There may be very few stars. I mean, that very first step. Wow. As far as I could tell, there doesn't seem to be any other type of first step that could have led to that. At least that's what theory seems to be saying.
Yeah, so we'd have nothing. It'd be pretty boring.
I love the idea of the dawn of chemistry. First chemical reactions ever.
All right, so have you guys heard this one? I think we might have spoken about this a year ago, but this was a paper that was recently published about reanimating dead pig brains. So this paper was presented a year ago, and then it was just recently published, so the press is presenting it again as if it's new. It is an interesting study that is then overhyped, right? So this is kind of the theme that we're going on so far. This episode is what's really going on, and the media somehow finds a way to overhype it. So what researchers did, and some of these researchers are at Yale, they're neuroscientists at Yale, they took pig heads, right? So decapitated pigs, mm-hmm. 4 hours after death, and so they have pig brains that were dead for 4 hours, and then they tried to keep them alive. They perfused them in a pulsatile fashion, so deliberately to replicate like a beating heart. They perfused them with a formula that includes nutrients and oxygen and preserve the kind of things that would minimize cell death after an injury, you know.
Apoptosis. All right, so right after decapitation, they started doing this.
4 hours. The brains are now dead for 4 hours.
Okay.
Now, the question is, how much activity are they going to see when they do this?
Well, you do a real good job. You may see a lot.
Yeah, it's not surprising that you would see activity.
Brain in a jar, yeah.
Yeah. They also, Bob, this is interesting, they put in a sedative in the formula because they wanted to make absolutely sure that these pig brains would not wake up.
Oh my God, sedative?
Which I think is a probably, I said that was an abundance of caution because
yes,
I don't think there was much of a chance of that happening.
All right. So, first of all, you got to clarify something. So, 3 minutes or so, give or take, depending on the individual, after respiration stops and the brain is oxygen starved, that it starts to literally fall apart.
That's when you start to get brain damage.
So, how could there be any neuronal activity 4 hours after?
That is the question, right? That is the very question for this study. So what they found was they observed in these, you know, 4 hour old pig brains where they were perfused at 4 hours, cytoarchitecture, attenuation of cell death, the restoration of vascular, dilatory, and glial inflammatory responses, spontaneous synaptic activity, and active cerebral metabolism.
Can you say that in English for everyone?
Yes. So they basically found some remnants of cell function. So not all the cells were dead, and some of the cell functions that they were looking at were still active, including some synaptic activity. Remember, synaptic activity is when one neuron communicates to another. Mm-hmm. So spontaneous synaptic activity and some metabolism. So they were metabolizing oxygen and nutrients. But at the same time, there was a absence of global electrocorticographic activity. So no electrical activity, right? So these brains were not active. These pigs were not waking up. No, everyone knew they weren't going to wake up. This was more activity than they were expecting. You know, this has some implications. There's legitimate implications, and then there's the hype, which we'll get to second.
So, Steve, now how about when somebody, say they're doing surgery on somebody, or they pull somebody, they get somebody late to the hospital, and they die. They say, brain death. They do their examinations and they say there's brain death. There's no electrical activity. So are you saying that there could potentially, if they could get the heart pumping and get some, you know, perfusion into the dead brain, that there may be some of this activity that we're seeing in the pig brains, but they're just not granular enough to see it, in that situation?
Yeah. But the question is, this is not functioning cells, right? This is cells that have not completely died yet, but they're not able to do their job, I think is a good way to think about it. So we know that cellular death doesn't happen instantly when an organism dies, right?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
It's a process.
Exactly.
And that process begins a few minutes after the heart stops, after, you know, the global functioning of the organism ceases. But depending on the cell type, right? So the brain cells are the first to go, pretty much, with brains starting to get irreversible damage even at 3 minutes. The last cells in the body are probably not dying for about 72 hours, right?
Right.
Maybe even a little bit after that. So it takes anywhere from 3 minutes to 3 days for all the different cell types in the body to die off. By 3 days, basically all the cells are dead at that point. Then there's just bacteria, which then eats you. So it's not a surprise that 4 hours after a body dies, that there is cellular activity.
Right. So where's the surprise?
Well, the surprise was that it was in the brain, which is supposed, you know, the idea was that the brain dies a lot quicker than that, that the, you know, there's irreversible damage at a cellular level. But that this level of activity that they're seeing doesn't mean that these cells would ever fully recover or become fully functional, or that their destiny to undergo spontaneous apoptosis is not a foregone conclusion, right? But it does say that maybe it opens the door a crack to preventing some of these cells from dying. You know, they're still, again, the cytoarchitecture means that the cells are still basically intact. Attenuation of cell death, their cells are dying more slowly, like because they're being reperfused now. And then the blood vessels seem to be working. Some of the metabolic activity seems to still be going on. So cellular death has not been completed yet at this point.
So this wouldn't have any impact then on saying somebody comes in and their heart stopped 5 minutes ago. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily help us deal with a situation like that. This is something like an end game for the last vestiges of the cells.
This study, no. But what use is this study? Oh, okay, there's a little bit more of a flicker of activity at the cellular level in a four-hour dead pig brain. If we, like, you know, give it all the nutrients and oxygen it needs to function, it actually will do some stuff. So what does that mean? So the point of this is to better understand the process of cell death after brain injury. So maybe
who knows?
Not this study, but this could be a model, right? This can give us a research and experimental model by which we can study the process that happens after the brain loses oxygen or whatever, after a heart attack or a stroke or whatever, something where the brain is deprived of oxygen. What is the process that it happens, and where are the points where we can intervene to maybe minimize or reduce the amount of damage that results, assuming we ever get the heart going again and we get bring the person back to life? So this could be a good research paradigm. That's like one of the legit points here. You know, and we did learn that, oh, okay, there's actually more going on in the brain than we thought at 4 hours, and there's still a little flicker of metabolic-type activity going on, and the damage isn't quite as irreversible at this point as we thought. But there's no brain activity, right? The EEG is still totally flat, although they would have to do the same study without any sedatives to be sure that it's completely flat. You know, it could be that some of it's being suppressed by the medication. But I mean, I don't think that they used enough to like induce a coma, because I suspect that would have interfered with the research that they were doing. I doubt this would ever leave. Again, it's always hard to predict where future technology is going to go. But this certainly does not imply, this study, the amount of activity that they're seeing does not imply that we can pull a brain that's been dead for 4 hours back into wakeful consciousness. Not at all. It's nowhere even near that. And so that's one implication, one hype implication that's just not true. And then the other thing is that's like, is not true. Like this makes us rethink or redefine the boundary between life and death. No, it doesn't.
Oh God, they're saying that?
Yeah. Yes. Are. Yeah. This does not in any way confuse us about the boundary between life and death. First of all, it already is kind of a gray zone. It's not like it's this makes it even more gray because you do have the various types of death. You know, there is your heart stopping versus brain death versus cellular death, you know, for example. So we already knew that there were different ways to define death and that cells survive after the organism as a whole dies. The cells will still survive for up to 3 days.
Steve, who said that? Who said that this is blurring the lines?
Almost every news outlet went with that.
Okay. No researcher said that.
No.
Of course not.
And the other idea that this provokes that most of the news outlets would opened up with something like this, and then they eventually got to what was actually happening. But you know, of course, you invoke the Futurama type brain in a jar.
Of course.
And the thing is that basic thing is not impossible. You know, I think you'd have to get to the brains long before they've been dead for 4 hours. Maybe if they did it right, like within 3 minutes of death, if they, you know, hooked the brain up to some kind of a situation where it was being perfused and getting oxygen and nutrients.
The Hedimator 2000.
Yeah, then sure. Okay. There's no reason why it theoretically would not be possible. And that's fun to think about. I mean, you know, interesting from a sci-fi point of view, because let's say we could do that. Let's say we could, you know, kill a pig, for example, and then instantly take its brain out and put it in a machine that was perfusing it and providing all the oxygen and nutrients that it needs and maintaining a homeostatic environment. Right.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting because, I mean, what would the impact be on the mind? You know, what impact does the body and perception and proprioception and all that have on the mind? I mean, there's also, I mean, Steve, isn't it true that hormones and things like that and other parts of your body can have an impact on how you think? And a bare brain isn't going to be 100% you mentally, so you know, so to speak.
Well, we don't know, right? We don't know what that possible consciousness would be like, you know, disembodied that way. And how would we know? How would we communicate with it? And how cruel would it be to do that?
Just you know, screaming for centuries.
So,
Bob.
I wonder how long we could keep a brain alive doing that, theoretically. And then you know, the only way we would know is if we were able to interface it with some kind of artificial output.
Yeah.
But then by doing that, we would change its situation because now it's interfacing with something. I mean, there's no reason to think that we won't eventually get to that level of technology. And there's going to be, you know, taking the first steps into that, into like, this research is not this at all. But, you know, the point where we're actually able to keep a brain functioning to the point where it can generate wakeful consciousness, what's the ethics surrounding that kind of research? Which to me is very similar to the ethics surrounding creating a self-aware AI, right? It's the same thing with flipping that switch, and now you have something that experiences its own existence, but it's just code. I mean, it's weird to think about that. What are our ethical obligations to things like that, you know?
Yeah.
Call that the Max Headroom experience.
I hope I see it.
Yeah.
Bob.
Not literally myself, but.
Well, right. Yeah.
Watch other people experience it.
What if, like, you go into the hospital and then you wake up and you're like,
you're in a jar. A
brain floating in a jar. Yeah.
I'd be like, cool. Tell me
Twilight.
How you did it.
Twilight Zone time.
Anything that does what Bob said, where it's basically like someone like just screaming in some type of weird oblivion. Like we really got to stop that from happening.
Right. The torturous existence aspect of all of this. Yeah.
I would think feedback, having a reliable feedback would be a prerequisite to actually trying to carry that out. Like how do we know what's being experienced? Can we communicate with them? If you can't communicate with them and if they can't experience anything, then it's clearly pure torture.
How do you get to that point ethically though? That's a bridge that you gotta cross. I don't know.
That reminds me also of that Dark Mirror episode. Remember the one
Which one?
Like you could put people into a computer simulation for like a million years. Yeah.
That episode stuck with me for days after I watched it.
I didn't see it. So was that like as torture or prison or something?
Yeah.
Right. They could emulate a mind in a computer with amazing fidelity. And this woman was put into like basically a house computer. The owner of the house had a duplicate of her brain created and put into the house computer. And the representative from the company who makes the technology was talking to the woman like, okay, you're not really that woman anymore. You are a duplicate and you need to take care of this house. And the woman's like, I'm not going to do that. And she's like, okay. He hits a button and he walks away. And then he comes back like a minute later. But in her world, he came back 6 months later. And she says, I will do anything you want me to do ever. Whatever you want, I will do it. And to think, imagine being alone in like a white room for 6 months. You would go mad, I would think, thinking about what she went through. For him, it was a minute. For her, it was 6 months.
Yeah.
Cool episode.
I mean, if I had City of Heroes on a computer, I'd be okay for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But anything beyond that, probably not.
Oof.
Okay, Evan.
Whoa. Yeah.
This is old news, new news again thing. Tell us about this fake miracle cure.
It is old news, but there is new news behind the old news, as you said.
Yes.
Our friends at the Genesis 2 Church of Health and Healing. Oh, yeah, that's a thing. They held a gathering at a hotel in Leavenworth, Washington this past Saturday to promote their miracle cure. Yep, a miracle cure that the FDA warns people to stop using it and throw it away. Yep, the same FDA that's been doing this for a decade when it comes to this particular cult and their magic sacrament solution. So they invited members of the public through a Facebook event page to attend what they called their effective alternative healing session. Mm-hmm. And for the modest donation of $450 per person, or the bargain rate for couples, $800 per couple, you not only receive membership in the organization, you receive packages of Miracle Mineral Solution, or MMS for short.
That's now, sweet, man.
Participants are promised they will acquire the knowledge to help heal many people of this world's terrible diseases. Oh, wow. So what is Miracle Mineral Solution, you may be asking yourself? Well, it's 28% sodium chlorite in distilled water. That is the equivalent to industrial strength bleach.
Yeah. It's what it is. It's industrial strength bleach. Yeah.
Proponents recommend diluting MMS in either water or a food acid such as lemon juice, which results in the formation of chlorine dioxide. Yum. And what kind of things do rational people do with chlorine dioxide? Well, they use it to sterilize medical and laboratory equipment, to clean surfaces, rooms, and tools, especially within an operating room environment. Chlorine dioxide is used in the electronics industry to clean circuit boards and as a bleach in the paper and textile manufacturing processes. Yes, you should be consuming this, right?
I mean, you just got to let that sink in. They are drinking bleach. Bleach.
As a miracle cure.
Yeah.
Good for
what
else?
As a cure-all. Unbelievable.
And Jay, you know why? It's because, well, a man, his name is Jim Humble, who is a former Scientologist, who also believes he is a 1-billion-year-old god who originated from the Andromeda Galaxy. Yep, that Jim Humble, he says we should be taking this concoction. Now, I checked out his claim, and it does check out. It turns out astronomers estimate the age of the Andromeda Galaxy is about 10 billion years old, mm-hmm. So his 1-billion-year-old claim does not violate that premise, so he's okay there.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Humble calls diseases like diabetes and hypercholesterolemia fake and made-up diseases, right? Fake news, fake diseases. And according to this billion-year-old god from the Andromeda Galaxy, MMS can be used to successfully treat AIDS, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, malaria, herpes, tuberculosis, most cancer, and just about any other ailment. He claims that so far, over 5 million people have used MMS, and that hundreds of thousands of lives have been saved as a result. So that's the claim, and if it weren't a 1-billion-year-old god professing it, one might call this extraordinary. All right, but what really happens when a person drinks this stuff? All right, when taken as directed, several things can and do happen, such as nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, potentially leading to dehydration and reduced blood pressure. And if the solution is diluted less than instructed, it could cause damage to the gut and red blood cells, potentially resulting in respiratory failure. Mm-hmm. So the purveyors of this poison, the people who set up this meeting in Leavenworth, Washington, they invited the public to come consume bleach with them. And these sellers attribute these kinds of side effects, such as vomiting, nausea, diarrhea, to the product actually working. You see, you're getting better because of these things
because it's damaging your internal organs. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. This is proof that it's working. Oh, boy. Sodium chlorite. That is the main ingredient in MMS. 1 gram of this stuff can be expected to cause all of these things, including the shredding of internal mucous membranes, such as those of the large and small intestine, and even have life-threatening hemolysis in persons who are deficient in glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase.
And you said one gram, Ev.
Rhymes with mayonnaise. 1 gram. 1 gram of that sodium chloride, the main ingredient in MMS. Okay, so that's bad, right? It gets worse. So these people, part of this Genesis 2 church, this cult, basically, they go to poor countries such as Haiti and the Dominican Republic, African countries, as a cheap remedy for all sorts of problems that the people of these countries regularly experience. So if that's not taking advantage of desperate people, I don't know what is. Not only that, proponents of MMS give these things to autistic children.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Force them to have it. And not only ingest it orally, but they sometimes bathe them in it and they give them enemas with this stuff.
Sweet Jesus. Enemas?
Enemas. Dave Gorski has written pretty extensively on this in several articles over the past few years at Science-Based Medicine. And he brings up a particular individual as one example of this kind of craziness going on. Her name is Carrie Rivera. She runs a clinic in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. She calls it the Autism O2 Clinicia Hyperbarica. And in her website, she says that, yes, she gives MMS by mouth and by enema. Also, she describes how, as you up the dose of this stuff, you'll see the autistic child do more stimming, which is what? Acting out, you know?
Self-stimulation.
Self-stimulation, right. Which is, you know, they say, oh, well, that's the child getting better. But could it also be that the child is suffering horribly at their hands and has no other way to express themselves but doing this? Yeah, so Rivera, apparently believing in MMS, thinks that this increase in stimming behavior is a good thing, indicating the treatment is working, and she also discusses how the autistic children subjected to the therapy will develop diarrhea, but that's okay because it's detox diarrhea.
Yeah, of course.
And he says in parentheses, whatever that's supposed to mean, as if there were such a real thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the religious angle, right? They're not selling a cure. They're just giving a religious sacrament for a donation. That's sort of the end run they're trying to make.
And that sticks to the wall.
Apparently, it's working. Yeah,
right, yeah. I know.
Remarkable.
It does stick to the wall, and it's really sad and pathetic. You know, you would think at this point, after the societies around the world have existed for as long as they have, that we would have found a way to legally stop people from drinking poison.
Right.
To stop the purveyors of the poison from actually delivering their wares to the consumers.
Right. That's the point. It's not so much I want to take away your freedom to drink poison. It's more you shouldn't be able to sell this stuff and make claims that it's a miracle cure. And you shouldn't be able to pour it down the throats of children. That's, I think, the undeniable thing. People want to do stupid things to themselves. I mean, okay, you can make an argument that they have a right to do that, but not sell poison or give it to kids.
Yeah,
that's right.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time.
Hey guys, last week I played this sound. What is that?
It's a sound you hear at an arcade or something, but it's probably not right.
It's totally an 80s arcade sound. Definitely sounds like that.
Sounds like it, right. But yeah. That's not it.
That's not it, no.
Of course not. That'd be two. Simplistic.
So Evil Eye wrote in and said, it sounds to me like a failed pinball launch. So he was on the same page.
Yeah, like, there you go.
Like going up the side after the plunger hits it and failing to go all the way out of the top and rolling back down to the plunger.
I think I've done that many times.
Yeah. Greg Moat wrote in and said, that is definitely a multi-axis servo gantry as used in things like 3D printers. Sounds like it's making a series of arcs and lines, perhaps creating a 3D model of the SGU logo. So Greg, that was a very good guess. I totally hear what you're hearing. You're not correct, but you're moving in the right direction. So we have a winner from last week, and this was sent in by a listener named Fred Murata. And Fred said, dear Jay, I think I might actually know what this week's noisy is. It sounds to me like stepper motors, which I guess could be used for just about anything, on a computerized Godu telescope mount. I have an Orion Sirius telescope mount that sounds very similar to this. If I'm right, I'm guessing this is a larger version because it sounds a little bit louder than mine. So that, yes, you're correct. So here's what the person who sent this in, Bob Benedict, said. He said, attaches an MP3 recording of the Skywatcher EQ8 German equatorial telescope mount hunting for its home position. This computerized mount has encoders that allow it to align left, I'm sorry, to align itself before an astronomy session. The sounds are an artifact of the way the stepper motors are driven. Check that out.
Cool.
What do you think of that? That is a telescope stepper motor positioning the telescope.
Huh.
So listen to it again now that you know, and tell me if you heard that. No?
Okay.
Pretty
so
cool.
Familiar.
I just think when I hear that, this is weird. I there's something very odd about that sound to me, and I know that I don't have synesthesia, but when I hear that thing, bloom, bloom, I kind of feel like I see rainbow colors. There's something about it that my brain is transmogrifying that sound into like a rainbow, which is kind of cool.
I could see that.
Yeah, it's cool. So thank you so much, guys, for the guesses. I will be going right to this week's new noisy. This was sent in by a listener named Ole Sumflith. Ole sent in a cool noisy that I will be playing for you right now.
Wittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization. Due to our release through factories and automobiles every year of more than 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which helps air absorb heat from the sun, our atmosphere seems to be getting warmer. This is bad. Well, it's been calculated a few degrees rise in the Earth's temperature would melt the polar ice caps.
Wow. Speak the truth, my friend, right? So, of course, I want to know as much as you can tell me about this, you know, who said that, when, under what circumstance, anything that you can tell me would be a good guess. God, I love stuff that is clearly from an era like that. You could just hear like Walt Disney in the background almost. You know what I mean? You know, that sound, the music, mm-hmm. the voice, all of those elements to me are just, it's just so powerful. I love it. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something cool, please, come on, send it to me right now. Just don't be lazy just for about 30 seconds and email me that sound at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, we have a question. This one comes in from Adam from Western Australia. And Adam writes, I've been listening to the show for about a year now and have started referring back to original studies when I read things in the news. I only have a high school education, though, and have no idea how to tell if a journal is of high quality with publications that can be relied on. Is there a quick way to know for beginners, or do I just need to scroll through, weeding out the bad ones by looking for ESP papers? Thanks for sharing your expertise. If you're ever in remote Western Australia and need a bulldozer fixed, I'd be happy to return the favor. I'm a diesel mechanic. That, you know, just last week, Adam, I was... No. So,
you had me going for a second, Steve.
Yeah, so all of our Western Australia bulldozer fixing needs. Thank you. Yeah. So this is a hard one. Like, there's no real quickie guide to how to know if a scientific journal is reliable or not. But there are some rules of thumb that might help you. First of all, good on you for going to the original source publication.
Yeah.
That is what we recommend. Don't trust the press releases or the news reporting, as we were just discussing for many things this week. They're often hyped. They don't quite get to the core of what they're talking about. Or they, there's even worse studies out there. We didn't talk about the beard one, right? The studies this week saying, being hyped as, scientists say that men's beards are dirtier than dog's hair.
Oh, yeah. I read that.
Yeah. No, please. Sorry. But anyway, so here are some rules of thumb. First of all, there is definitely a top tier of scientific journals that it's a good bet that there's been at least some decent editing and peer review and some reasonable threshold there. So in medicine, like, are you talking about the Lancet, the New England Journal of Medicine? For the Annals of Internal Medicine, the big name journals, you're probably okay. And it's not that hard to know like what the top tier science journals are in any field. Another good sort of rule of thumb, like how basic is the name? So if the name of your journal is Neurology and that's it, that's probably a top tier neurology journal, right? Like if it's Paleontology, that's the name of the journal. They've probably been around for a while to get that name. If their name is almost anything else, like, or if it's even, the less basic the name is, probably the more new it is. Like if the name of the journal is Experimental Research Design and blah, 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 you know, like they have to throw in enough words there that they can get to a unique journal name, even though it might sound superficially legitimate.
Double check it.
Yeah, those journals are probably newer, and they because you can make a million permutations of that name. But if it's just a single word or sort, there's a certain basic formulas for common basic journal names like Annals of X or just one word. You know, the bottom line is, you know, Google. Now that we have Google, you could of course look it up. You could look up the journal and probably read something about it to see like how well respected it is. There is something that peer-reviewed journals have, which is called the impact factor, and that has to do with how often articles published in that journal get cited by other articles. And that's a good measure, but you have to be familiar with impact factors and what they actually mean, so that may not help you unless you're already kind of familiar with the journals. But the bottom line is also is that there is no journal that is so respectable that they can't publish crap, right? So we don't go on the authority of any journal. We always want to look at the study itself, and you want to see what the community is saying about that study. So even just going to the original article, while that's great, you're not done then. Then you want to say, okay, now what are the experts saying about this? Is this being generally accepted by the by their peers, or is it being highly criticized? And you still want to look at the details of the study itself. How big was the study? How well controlled was it? You know, does it sound like they're being fairly conservative? Are they overhyping their own results? Another thing about the journal, though, is does the journal seem to be a general science journal, meaning that they don't have a particular ideological agenda, right? Like, is it dedicated to a topic or is it dedicated to a certain point of view? So, for example, like a journal named Paleontology is just dedicated to a topic, the topic of paleontology. But if the journal article is like alternative views in paleontology, then it's like it's suggesting to you that there's a certain ideological filter that's in place. Then you have to be more cautious about it, know what that ideological filter is, right? Because that probably has an influence on their quality, like what they're willing to accept. And are they pushing an agenda? And then, of course, what they've published in the past is a good guide, too. As you said, you go trolling to see, you know, how many ESP papers do they publish? But it doesn't take that much time. And I usually do that. I do that with newspapers too. Like if I'm seeing an article from a newspaper I don't recognize, like it's not the Washington Post or the LA Times or whatever, not a big name newspaper, I will look at like what else are they publishing? And that often very quickly gives you a good idea what kind of quality you're talking about. I remember not too long ago, the first time I saw an article that was published by a newspaper called RT. That was the name of the newspaper. Do you guys know, are you familiar with RT? Do you know what that is?
Russian Retweet?
It's Russia Today. It is Russia a propaganda Today. Newspaper. It yeah. is a total yeah. propaganda newspaper.
Yeah.
But they're clever. It's for the West. It's not for Russians. It's
I
for
know.
The West. And so they publish a lot of articles that in and of themselves may be legitimate. And sometimes they're not legitimate. Sometimes it's pure propaganda. But they will publish news that is true if it serves their point of view. So what is their point of view? They're trolling and cherry picking for any news that calls into question corporate America. Mm-hmm. You know, the ethics and morality of corporations. So they're very, very anti-corporate. They're anti-capitalism in their stance. Like I remember, I think one of the first ones I saw was an anti-GMO article because that's something they'd like to push, anti-GMO as well. And then, of course, anything that is embarrassing to the American government, they'll also put forward. But it might be things like I've had articles from RT sent to me from, you know, Americans who are just, for example, liberal. And this was in right in line with their fairly mainstream or maybe a little bit extreme liberal ideology. And they had no idea that they were citing Russian propaganda.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Cause that's what, so anyway, that's, you have to, like, if RT is not a reliable source of information. It is literally a ideologically driven propaganda outfit serving the disinformation needs of a hostile foreign government. You know what I mean? That's like as bad as it gets. But then there's also, like, you know, Homeopathy Today. That's a homeopathy journal. Looking at a study published about homeopathy, if it's published in homeopathy, you know, a journal dedicated to a pseudoscience, obviously that's not reliable. And then there's a lot in the gray zone, like Psychology Today. Like they've published utter crap and they publish legitimate stuff too. And there it's like, doesn't tell you one way or the other. It could be fine. It could be not. You have to just evaluate the individual study and see what the community is saying about it. But thank you for that question, Adam. That's actually a really important skill for, I think, for any skeptic to have.
Definitely.
Yep. All right. Quick name that logical fallacy. Quick name. Right. You guys ready? This one comes from Ben. And Ben writes, just a quick question. Do you not think it's possible that there is a higher power that has orchestrated all of this? Meaning that couldn't some power have caused everything that science has shown? Now, I'm not one of those people that says the Earth is only 6,000 years old or whatever. I believe what science says, but I also feel like there must be something that caused everything to happen. Couldn't a God have been behind the Big Bang and evolution and all that? Thanks for your time. So what do you guys think about Ben's question? I know he's asking a question rather than making a statement. And there was a follow-up. I don't know. Maybe I should read his follow-up.
The answer is yes, there could be, but nobody knows because there's no evidence.
Argument from ignorance.
If he said there is a God because we can't prove he doesn't exist, that's the argument from ignorance. But he's just asking, how do we know there isn't a God? And so that's more of an unfalsifiable hypothesis. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's basically saying, I sort of answered his question. He came back with, but is there evidence that proves that God didn't or couldn't have created things to look like they evolved? Right.
Of course not. What the hell is that?
Indistinguishable. Right. So then I followed up and said, yeah, that is an unfalsifiable hypothesis. It's just like saying God created the entire universe 10 minutes ago, but he created it to look exactly as if it evolved over 13.4 billion years. Okay. There's, by the definition of your framing there, you can't possibly prove that wrong. I always think of that comedian who said, I'm beginning to suspect that people are secretly coming into my house at night and replacing all of my furniture with exact duplicates.
It sounds like something Stephen Wright would say.
It is Stephen Wright.
It is Stephen Wright.
So, yeah, which is funny because you realize, well, how would you know and why do you care? You know, and so that's sort of the same thing. How would you know and why do you care? If there's some force behind, but it's all unfolding according to natural laws and science, and that's what we study. That's really all we could know are the rules and the history and what it looks like happened, because that's what the process of science will show us. And then if you ask a metaphysical question, that is unfalsifiable, you could spin those yarns all day long. It doesn't get you anywhere because they're by definition unfalsifiable.
So the people who are suggesting we live in a simulated reality, you know, in a simulation of some sort, is that also considered unfalsifiable?
Yeah, no, it depends on your framing. Really. It depends on your framing.
I've heard examples of what could be done to potentially reveal that it's a simulation. So it's not completely completely unfalsifiable.
Yet they haven't undergone those tests or experiments because why?
Well, they're only falsifiable in theory. We don't have the ability to do the research just yet.
In fact, I think just recently didn't somebody write a paper that mathematically showed that if it were a simulation, then there would be obvious signatures of the simulation. And
obvious in that anybody could detect it?
Yeah, that we would have detected it by now.
Scientists would have.
Yeah, it would have made certain things impossible. Actually, I was thinking of doing a talk on that at one of our shows.
Yeah, that would be fun. That would be a fun talk. Are we living in a simulation? If you really do a deep dive on that. It superficially sounds like a stupid question, but there's actually a lot of philosophy and cosmology even behind it. All right. Well, thank you for the question, Ben. Not trying to pick on you because we did have a back and forth. It's a good concept, the idea that questions need to be falsifiable before they're of any use. You know, they're not even wrong. So you're correct in that it's not wrong. We can't prove he's not. There isn't a God behind everything. But the point is it's not even wrong because it's not even in the arena of science because it's not falsifiable.
Not even wrong.
Not even wrong, right? All right, guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake-a-rooney. And I ask you guys to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week because we were doing the show early because we have the no-show this weekend. And it's always hard when we do an early show to come up with three new news items. So I have a theme. And the theme is dinosaurs. You guys know all about dinosaurs, right?
You did that kinda recently,
sometimes,
but okay.
I do and sometimes I don't.
Okay, we'll see how much you know about dinosaurs. Item number one. Who here thinks they know a lot about dinosaurs? Who's a big dinosaur fan?
Bob.
Kara.
Kara is.
She's I know, very
she,
much.
Well, if she made it, if she had made it.
Kara, you got 10 seconds. Come on.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Despite their reputation, the average size of an adult dinosaur was about the size of a human, and most known species were smaller. Item number two. There are over 700 known and named species of non-avian dinosaurs. And item number three. Microraptors, small feathered dinosaurs, had four wings. Evan, go first.
Average size of an adult dinosaur was about the size of a human, and most known species were smaller. It makes sense to me that this would be the case. There is a survival advantage inherent if you are smaller, I think. If you're larger, you need more food, you need more room to breathe, although you are probably more likely to be top of the food chain at that point. But still, you have to consider perpetuating your own type of dinosaur that you are. So I think there would be a lot more smaller ones that would, when you average it all out, it comes out to be about 2 meters, what size of a human, maybe a little smaller. I think that one's right. The second one about over 700 known and named species of non-avian dinosaurs. Steve, I don't know if this is a lot, a little, or right on. I don't know. I mean, we could be talking 7,000 instead of 700, you know, the old factor of 10 rule. So I have to hold that one out as a possibility for being fiction, certainly. And then this last one about microraptors, small feathered dinosaurs. They had four wings. Something tells me we've touched on this before, although maybe not microraptors, but we've touched on this before. There were sub-wings under the wings, or like you got the outer wings and the under wings, which are much smaller but considered distinct. And I just seem to think that this has come up before, maybe years ago in a conversation. So that kind of leaves me with the 700 club here of known and named species. So That's the one I have the least confidence in, and therefore I'll go with that as the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
You know, this first one, the average size of an adult dinosaur was about the size of a human. There's something about that that rings true to me. You know, we tend to think that all these dinosaurs were gigantic, but there was a lot of smaller dinosaurs as well. I just don't know what the, you know, it's a great science or fiction item. You would think that there would be a lot of benefit to the smaller guys. Steve and I were just talking about this. Remember, Steve, you were saying like there was like this gigantic thing going on with dinosaurs for a while because but the prey was getting bigger, so the hunters had to get bigger, and then it just kept kind of like, you know, an arms race. The second one here, there's over 700 known and named species of non-avian dinosaurs. Damn, I agree with you, Ev. Like, okay, that sounds like a lot, but then at the same time, it doesn't sound like that many at all. Mm-hmm. So I have two reasons to not like that number. And then to go down to the Microraptors, damn, Steve. I mean, I guess didn't the Microraptors have like wing-like feathers coming off their feet? That's what I think could be considered the second set of wings.
Ooh, foot wings like Hermes.
Yeah, like their feet though. It's the feet, but they would act like wings because there's you know, I know this is true because I have children, I have more dinosaur books in my house than most people children do.
Distinct so. Advantage right there.
Yeah, I mean I think they do. I'm pretty sure these guys do. They look funky. When you look at a picture of them, you're like, what's going on with that bird thing, you know? So if that one to me is definitely science, then I think it's the middle one here, the 700 known, I think I'm going to go with as the fake.
And Bob?
Is that so the average is human size or less? Is that mean, median, or mode? Don't answer. It doesn't matter. yeah, I guess I could buy that. Yeah, the 700, oof, I have no idea. I just have no idea if that is way off. And I'm not liking three either. I've never seen any picture of any dinosaur with four wings. But how could I argue?
Duncan had it, I think.
How could I argue though with a Jay's huge dinosaur kid book collection? four wings. Because I mean, when I think of obviously, and maybe that's what you want me to think. Because when you think four wings, you're thinking you know, those Avatar flying creatures, which were you know explicit, obvious flapping wings, not some little Hermes little feathery doodads coming off your feet. Yeah, I'll go with the crowd. 700 fiction.
Okay, going, looking for security in the crowd. Okay.
Oh, this time, yes.
Kara could have picked up a little positioning here tonight.
Steve would have picked her last, though.
I think so.
Probably. All right. So I think you guys had the easiest time with number three, so I'll take that one first. Microraptors, small feathered dinosaurs, had four wings. You guys all think this one is science, although Bob was the least certain of the three of you. And this one is science.
Wow.
Yes, those buggers had four wings. Jay, you're right. I'm sure you've seen it in one of your
books. It was on the feet?
It's on the feet. They had their legs were wings as well. They had enough feathers, and they weren't just like covering it. They were going out like wings. They were actually
They're very wing-like.
Yeah, they're
So but it's weird when you see the picture, it looks kind of weird.
Of course it does.
Right? Yeah.
But it just shows you how much adaptive radiation there was with the feathered dinosaurs, that they were all over the place. Again, you got to get rid of this linear model in your head of evolution. They weren't evolving into birds. They were evolving in all kinds of directions, just one of which led to modern birds.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, some dinosaurs evolved into modern cats. That's it.
That's not true. But it's probably like if the Microraptors were successful and the other groups weren't, then we would think of all birds is having four wings. That would just be normal to us. That's what birds, whatever they were, whatever we called them, right? But that's not the direction of the group that happened to survive.
Didn't South Park have like some monkey with two asses?
Oh, the four-assed baboon.
Four-assed monkey, yeah. Yeah. But that wasn't natural evolution, though. That was the Isle of Dr. Moreau kind of thing going on there.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
If I recall that correctly. All right, we'll go back to number one. Despite the reputation, the average size of an adult dinosaur was about the size of a human, and most known species were smaller. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Good job, Steve.
Damn.
So they were bigger or smaller?
Oh, they were bigger. Yeah. So But this is like a myth going around the internet now. So, you know, like people think that it's a myth that dinosaurs were all huge, and in fact they were small. But actually, that's the myth. But they were huge. Now, yes, there were small dinosaurs. Absolutely, there were very small dinosaurs, and there were a lot of small dinosaurs. And there is, it's like people are just extrapolating too much. Like they think they learned something new, and then they extrapolate it into a hyper dramatic direction. Right? That's probably a fallacy in and of itself. The appeal to drama or whatever. But and there is, so here's the little factoid that makes people feel like they know what they're talking about, is that there's a little bit of a bias in the fossil record. It's biased towards bigger species because they're easier to fossilize and to find. But that doesn't mean that dinosaurs were therefore small. They were, Jay, what you and I were talking about was with mammals, actually, not dinosaurs, because okay. They discovered, in a drawer somewhere, a giant lion. It's like, yeah, there was an age of gigantism among mammals after, you know, the dinosaurs died, that there are times and places where through this, you know, competition between prey and predators, there's selective pressure for everyone to get bigger. So it probably was just that the environment supported big herbivores, and there was also probably a pressure for herbivores to get bigger just because they would be more efficient in terms of digesting food for some reason. And then predators had to get bigger to eat the bigger herbivores. So then the herbivores got bigger still to be too big for the predators. So then predators got even bigger, you know, mm-hmm. So there were multiple factors, but it was reinforced by this competition between predators and herbivores. So yeah, they were legit huge. There's something like the average, if you take the average size of dinosaurs, it's like elephant size or like huge, many, many tons. Even accounting for the smaller ones, there were certainly many more larger dinosaurs as well. Hmm. But it's fun because they always like those ones where the myth is the myth, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. All of this means there are over 700 known and named species of non-avian dinosaurs is science. That's a lot of different species of dinosaurs.
Hmm.
But of course, there's a lot more that existed that we have not yet discovered. There's a ton more to be discovered out there. But it is interesting to know. I mean, like most people who know about dinosaurs probably know a dozen or so species, right? Like how many could you name off the top of your head? Yeah, I mean, more if you're into that sort of thing or if you have a kid who's into that sort of thing. But 700, you know, like I defy anyone who's not a dinosaur paleontologist to rattle off 100, let alone 700 dinosaur names.
Sure.
That's a lot of variation. It's a lot of, and some of them are freaking weird. Some of these dinosaurs got weird. You know, I mean, like they've like all kinds of shapes of their mouths and their teeth and multiple rows of teeth. And there's this one guy, Mamenchisaurus, who had such a long neck. His neck was half the length of its entire body, including its tail. But you look at a picture of it and of the bones, it's like this, like a brontosaurus looking body, right? Because it's one of those dinosaurs. But the neck is just incredibly long. Like, how did this thing even stand up? You would think it would just have fallen over. Amazing.
Crazy. All right. So here's what we have to hope. We find a lot more known and named species of non-avian dinosaurs that are smaller and brings that average down from elephant size to human size, and then we will eventually be correct in science or fiction.
Yeah, probably not going to happen.
So we'll hold out for that one.
Cool. So if you haven't looked at dinosaurs in a while, just look up, you know, weird dinosaurs or just species of dinosaurs. You're not like the dozen that everybody knows, you know, like Triceratops and T-Rex and Brontosaurus and those guys, but try to look for some of the less well-known ones. There's some really interesting species that we've uncovered. Okay, well, thanks for playing, guys. That was a fun one.
Yeah, that's challenging. Right.
I think,
challenging.
Is that my first sweep of 2019?
I don't know.
Enjoy it, Steve.
I did. I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah, you know. I wonder how Kara would have done.
Not a full sweep.
Mm.
Well, yeah, it's true. It's a sweep with an asterisk. Okay, Evan, give us a quote.
People should adopt a healthy lifestyle, which includes appropriate exercise, food choice, and weight control and safety behavior. Beyond that, They should have an appropriate level of skepticism towards health information in the media and be skeptical of anyone who says he's practicing alternative or complementary medicine. And that is sage advice from our friend Stephen Barrett, known as the founder of Quackwatch, who's been doing this longer than us. And you know,
yeah, tireless.
When we were just getting into skepticism in the mid-90s, he was already well-established and doing a lot of the heavy lifting, especially in the realms of alternative and complementary medicine and making us aware of the pitfalls. So,
yeah, encyclopedic website, you know, going over all kinds of stuff. It's still a great resource.
Definitely.
And in fact, he basically gave it to science-based medicine, and we're wikifying it, making it like a Wikipedia style.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. The core there, the idea that, yeah, beyond the basics, like, yeah, eat right, exercise regularly, keep your weight under control, some basic lifestyle factors. Everything else is bullshit, right? When it comes to like,
yeah.
All like the detox and the antioxidants, all that other stuff is just nonsense. There's no evidence. It's just faddish nonsense.
So exercise, healthy food, weight control, and healthy skepticism. That's it.
Well, I mean, I would add get good sleep, you know.
Sure.
Everything in moderation. Don't smoke at all. You know, gotcha. Alcohol in moderation. Things like that everyone knows because it's basic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Everything else is mostly nonsense. You're better off assuming at first that it is nonsense and then only believing it if
it's
a reliable source. Yeah, that's like a good first approximation.
Reliable, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other point I make is that the basic things that everyone knows, like those basic lifestyle factors that we talked about, that's 95% of it, 99% of being healthy. And everything else, even if there is something legitimate in there, you're now nibbling around the 1% that's left. And it's probably not worth a lot of time and attention. You'll do more for yourself just by don't lose sight of the basics. The other thing that drives me crazy is people who are trying. I take my antioxidants every day, but then they smoke. You know, it's like, well, that's it makes no sense.
And you're not, it doesn't fix the other. Like, you know, you can't do something horrible and then do something really good and think they neutralize each other.
Right.
It doesn't.
That's right. I had my like Whoppers and my Diet Coke. So I'm
exactly. Take care of the 95%. And we know what the 95% is. Don't worry about the 5%.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. All right.
All right.
I think all you guys are amazing people. How about that?
All right. Thanks, Jay.
Can't disagree.
I think that's an unfalsifiable hypothesis, Jay.
Steve dismisses compliments with skepticism.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
You got it.
Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.